Good evening. And we started the year last time with marijuana, and now we move on to gene editing. This is all a part of what I hope will be a year-long theme on new issues. I don't know what we'll do next. We'll have to come up with something else that's brand new. If there is nothing new, we'll have to invent something. But what we're talking about is the act of changing the genes of a fetus, of an adult, a fertilized egg. And it's new in the sense that it has no direct legal precedent in Judaism. There are aspects of it that intersect with halacha, with Jewish law, which we'll talk about. But in terms of the fundamental issue of changing an organism and potentially its descendants by manipulating its genes, that question, how does a Jew approach the question of whether that's an appropriate thing to do? Does Judaism have anything to say? So there have been a few articles on the issue over the last several years, but nothing terribly definitive. And so what I'm going to present are my thoughts on it. They're first thoughts, and I reserve the right to change my mind and come back to you in December with an entirely different vision of how this works. But first, a little bit about the mechanism, because the mechanism itself is fascinating. The most popular mechanism that they're discussing these days is called CRISPR. If you think of the word in English, CRISPR, but drop the E. That's the word, and I sent out in my email a graphic that I'm sure made no sense to anybody that explains the science behind it. But if it made sense to you, that's wonderful. You're a better scientist than I am. But basically, the way it works is that you use a protein that's called Cas9, and it cuts out a particular gene that has been identified as dangerous. This protein is accompanied by a section of genetic code that identifies which genes should be clipped out, and the technique was actually learned from bacteria, which do this regularly. Somehow, bacteria managed to do this when the concern for bacteria is that they may be infected by a virus, and the virus puts its own code into the bacteria's genes. So the bacteria has a means of clipping out the code from the virus, and knowing when to clip out and what to clip out and where it will be repaired. All of the bacteria knows how to do this. We don't know how to do this. Bacteria know how to do this. We looked at the bacteria and learned how it can be done. It's a method that's been in development, in theory in development, for a while, but only the last couple of years has it become something practical. But they actually say that now that they know how to do it, it's not hard. They say any decent biochemist with a decent lab could carry this out. You don't need a multi-billion dollar research facility in order to do it. And so the question is, well, is it a good idea? It will not come as any surprise to know that internationally there's a moratorium on doing this on human beings. But it should also come as no surprise that that's going to change in the near future.
Is there a danger to taking the wrong gene?
You bet. And that's part of what we're going to have to discuss. There are serious dangers. It's called off-target effects. And we're going to have to come back to that. They are getting better by the day in terms of making sure that doesn't happen. Their method is actually quite solid. The moratorium is going to disappear, meaning they're going to allow this. And the reason they're going to allow it is because you can do so much good with this that they're not going to be able to hold it back. And I give you some illustrations of how this can be used. First of all, in an adult, if you take a look at your first source, this is from CNBC this past March. The article is titled, "Betting on the First Disease to be Treated by Gene Editing." I thought this was actually going to be like there's a Las Vegas line, you know, or something in London where they, you know, some of these gambling houses, well, they'll take bets on anything. So I didn't actually see that in the article. It just sounded like it. But listen to this quote. "Researchers don't doubt that CRISPR-based treatments will become widely available to patients. The only question is when. And they quote a professor of biochemistry from University of Western Ontario, David, I don't know if his name is pronounced Edgel or Edgel, but he thinks CRISPR treatments could be available within the next 2 to 3 years with modified T cells used to treat some types of cancer. There are already clinical trials for lung cancer in China, and a similar one slated to take place at the University of Pennsylvania was approved last June by the National Institutes of Health. What they're talking about doing is going into the cancer cell and actually clipping out the problematic genes. It's a remarkable thing. Like, you can just do that, and that's...
What do you mean, clipping out? Injecting? Or?
No, pulling out the genes that are a problem so that you're essentially taking the fangs out of the cancer cell. That's the idea.
They have to attack all the cells or just one?
So,
it'll multiply.
So if they attack one, then they've cut off whatever it could produce. They have to Right. Ultimately, they have to shrink the tumor down to a point where either it can be removed or it's no longer considered dangerous to the system. But it's mind-boggling and it's effective. They had an article out a couple of months ago about Duchenne's multiple sclerosis. And about how they've actually shown that they can do this in a human being. They can remove the illness. Now, you can't do this for everything. It isn't as though this works for any and all problems under the sun. You have to be able to identify where the genes are that are important, and it has to be a localized problem, meaning certain things are affected by multiple genes. It's not as simple as saying, cut out one thing and you're going to be fine. And then, you noted one problem, the concern for what if you cut out the wrong genes. But even if you cut out the right genes, you have to know what the impact is going to be long term. Not so much when you're dealing with disease, where the cancer is dangerous right now, let me cut it out and then worry about tomorrow or later. But when you deal with some other changes, which we're going to talk about, you have to worry about other effects. And here's an example of this. Source number 2, from an article from Technology Review called Engineering the Perfect Baby. They talk about something called germline engineering. And what they mean by that is, it's one thing to say there's an adult who has a disease, and I'm going to work on their cells to cut out the disease. But if you do this with a fertilized egg, and you change the genes, you could affect... Assuming you're dealing with germ cells, so to speak, meaning sperm and egg, you could be affecting what all their descendants are going to be like for all time. Right? You're going to affect not just one person's genes. You're affecting the whole line. So take a look at source number 2. Germline engineering is much further along than anyone imagined. Quote, what you are talking about is a major issue for all humanity, says Merle Berger, one of the founders of Boston IVF, a network of fertility clinics that is among the largest in the world and helps more than 1,000 women get pregnant each year. It will be the biggest thing that ever happened in our field. Berger predicts that repairing genes involved in serious inherited diseases will win wide public acceptance, and of course it will. Right? Imagine if someone told you, we can eliminate Tay-Sachs. Right? We can eliminate sickle cell anemia. Right? And the way we're going to do it, instead of right now, the way we do it right now is you do genetic testing on 2 people who want to get married, and you warn them right off the bat, you have a problem because you're both carriers. Yeah. But now they could get married, and they can have the fertilized egg tested. If the gene is in there, eliminate it. And it's all gone from future generations. So, for that reason, you bet it's going to win wide public acceptance. But it goes on to say, this fellow Berger says, the idea of using the technology beyond that would cause a public uproar because, quote, everyone would want the perfect child. People might pick and choose eye color and eventually intelligence. And that is where it gets complicated. Yes, Bev.
What strikes me here in the sentence it begins with, Berger predicts that the carrying genes, I find that an odd word, especially in what we were talking about. It seemed to me you've been suggesting that the gene is not repaired but eliminated.
Right.
And the notion of repairing strikes me as very odd. How do you repair a gene?
Right. And it's a turn of phrase, really. Because you're right. What they're really doing is, you could call it legitimately repairing DNA. Because the DNA is the sum of the genes that are there, and you're eliminating the problematic part. That would be a more accurate, I think, turn of phrase. But once you get to the issue of, we want to breed super intelligent children, it becomes, first of all, much harder to do. Like, when they deal with this on a sober level, the articles that try to talk about how this could be done, they all say this would be a long way away, simply because intelligence is much more complicated than the diseases that we're talking about. It's not a case of a single mutation of a single gene. There are so many different factors that will be involved. It has to be controlled by many different genes.
Furthermore, there are so many different kinds of intelligence.
Exactly. There are so many different kinds of intelligence.
You want to give birth to an artist or a mathematician. I mean, you can pick.
Yeah, correct. But you have to ask yourself, where does that lead? Right? What happens to our world when you try to do that? Let alone, what if you make mistakes? Right? What if in attempting to breed people who are superb mathematicians, you accidentally breed people who are, who have no sympathy for anybody else, because that somehow is tied in with being strong scientifically or mathematically, right? And they just don't feel. You breed mathematical geniuses who are also sociopaths. You can't know what your result is going to be when you're dealing with something as dicey as this. But let's say you didn't have that concern. Let's say that wasn't our issue. Let's pretend that you could actually, jump far enough into the future, and you could reprogram people's genes so that they would be hyper-intelligent and not in any way diminish anything positive about them. Would that be a good thing?
It's like a Germany when they
especially. It sounds an awful lot like eugenics.
Yeah, it does. It's scary.
It wouldn't be a good thing because different peoples would have that ability and they would even get more powerful than they are now. It wouldn't be fair to some other populations that can't do it.
Right. Part of the problem is the issue of access. Because you know that with a technology like this, the first people to get it are going to be the affluent.
Right.
And that's just going to increase the gap between people who have and people who have not.
Yeah.
Right? You know that. Because the people who have are going to breed their super intelligent children and give them everything. Yeah. And the ones who have not will be left behind. That's the way of everything. But here you're talking about something that is leaps and bounds beyond any gap we've seen in, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say, human history. It's one thing to say that some people will have more money than others, or even access to better education than others. But if you're able to say, these people are actually going to be bred to, as a class, have higher intelligence, I mean, you're talking about about creating a new class of human being, effectively.
This is a brave new world.
Yes, exactly. It's
this isn't something new. This is part of Hindu theology, that you have classes, and that certainly Brahmin classes are inherently smarter and better than anybody else. And the untouchables stay in the gutter and will stay there.
So is it good, though, to create that intentionally?
It's not something that you can prevent happening. You can't put toothpaste back in the tube. Once this wheel has started, there's not a hope in hell they'll ever be able to stop it. You say there are conventions that prevent testing on humans? Come on. You mean that someone in North Korea isn't trying to do it today?
Right. So I would say two things. One, I agree with you that all the conventions in the world are going to stop people who are motivated to do this. We saw that with cloning experiments. I think that's true. That said, I would say number one, our question is from our perspective, what should we be doing? As opposed to, you know, what's going to happen in terms of, you know, whatever goes on around the world. But number two, I think funding is a really big deal when you address things like this. To try to find the genes for intelligence is going to require a very serious amount of money, which can be cut off if the governments choose not to fund it.
Unless the government is the one who is saying, we're going to do the choosing.
Correct.
That's it. The Germans and the Japanese in World War II, I'm sure we're on the verge of doing this kind of experimentation.
Mm.
And do you think they would have stopped?
Well,
because there's an international convention that says so? You know, it just wouldn't happen.
Yeah.
There is something dangerous going on a much lower, a different level where people are doing ultrasound and finding whether it's a male or female and deciding whether that fetus should be aborted or not. So you can see that if that's taken off, this would even be...
Well, that's for sure a problem. That exists today.
Yeah.
That we know about. You know, I do a program every summer. It's a long story, but basically there's a program in which they bring pediatric residents from around the Middle East to University of Toronto to work together. And I think, have I told you about this before?
No, it's just I think our daughter-in-law got you involved.
Oh, that could be. It's about 5 years ago I started doing this program. And they bring Jordanians, and they bring Israelis, and they bring quote-unquote Palestinians, and they have Canadians. And one day, they have representatives of different religions come and sit on a panel and answer questions about medical ethics from a religious perspective. So there's a Catholic priest who comes, there's an Anglican who comes, I'm there, there's an imam who's there, there's a Buddhist, there's a Jain, and there's a Hindu. It's like a joke waiting to happen. We're all sitting there on the panel. But one of the issues that comes up is the issue of PGD, the issue of pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, where you look at the embryo before it is implanted to decide which one do I want to implant based on the traits. And the comment was made there from the Hindu that they have a big problem in the Indian community. It's a big issue, I'm told, in Brampton, in terms of the ratio of boys to girls, because everybody wants a boy. And it's created a crisis in the community there. So you're not wrong. It's for sure there. But this is that multiplied by so many other factors besides gender. I want to show you a third element because this one always, people get a kick out of this. And this is just from October 27th. But I've already told it to two different sets of people and everyone is very, very fascinated by this. This is the future of anti-aging. Many CRISPR human trials are currently being done in China on patients with HPV, HIV, and lung cancer. Quote, at first, it's going to be used only on cases where it's worth the risk, Robinson says, and on people who are willing to take the risk because they don't have many options. As to whether CRISPR will be used for vainer pursuits, think curing baldness, eliminating gray hair, erasing wrinkles, Robinson, 30, is optimistic. Quote, this isn't the first time that biotech has invaded the beauty space, she says. It's not yet real, but it's our hopeful reality. So you go into adults and you say, it's a gene that's making your skin get wrinkled, and we are now, forget the creams and forget all the other stuff, we're just going to use CRISPR. And you'll have eternally young skin. So I want to talk about this in terms of Jewish law and Jewish ethics. The one thing I don't want to invoke, only because it's its own discussion really, is the slippery slope conversation. The conversation that says, if you allow this, then the following is going to happen. I happen to believe that the slippery slope is a legitimate legal concept, but it's really, like, that could take an entire hour, and we have too many other facets to this. So I'm going to pretend slippery slope is not part of the conversation and simply say, what do I do about the case in front of me right now, as opposed to the case that's going to be in front of me, you know, in another 5 years? So let's go back for a minute to case one. Case number one is, to my mind, the simplest. Use for medical purposes in adults. Okay, not using it in order to make them fit their aesthetic image, but using it to cure cancer, to cure a diseased organ. So here, the most basic concern that we have is the one captured by source number 4, a simple verse, "You shall guard your lives greatly," which is to say, you have to be careful with your health. That's a Jewish obligation. And on that basis, I wouldn't be allowed to engage in this treatment if it were not proven to be safe. If I don't know this is safe, I'm not allowed to take risks on it. It's like any other risk-taking treatment. There's an obligation to make sure that it's going to be safe. However, risks which are considered normal within society, are permissible for the sake of gain. I think we've talked about source number 5 before. It's a passage from the Talmud that talks about somebody who is pursuing a job in which he has to endanger his health. And the warning that the Torah gives is to make sure you pay this person on time because he's putting his life on the line in order to make a living. Whether he's climbing a tree in order to get the fruit, whether he's working on a construction job, whatever it is, he exposes himself to risk. You have to respect that, and you have to pay the person on time. But the implication of the Talmudic discussion on this is that it's okay for him to endanger himself to make a living. Why? Because that's life. Everything has risks. Getting out of bed has risks. Crossing the street has risks. So, going to work has risks. Depending on what line of work it is, that'll determine the risk level. But we are okay with the idea that a person enters into some level of danger if it's what normal people endure in the course of normal life. So, to bring a practical application of that, source number 6, Rabbi Yaakov Breisch dealt with the issue of elective surgery. And he said, look at pregnancy. That's risky. Mm-hmm. He says, could one entertain the thought that a woman could not marry and give birth because she thereby endangers herself? It doesn't say whether it's marriage or giving birth that's the danger. I'm assuming he means the birth. He says, that is the way of the world. This is what you do. And since the public does it, he quotes you a verse from Tehillim, from Psalms, Shomer Psayim Hashem, God guards the fools. We have found this stated frequently in the Talmud regarding danger. The Talmud will say, since many people trample on it on a particular risk, God guards the fools. So too here, regarding his surgery, he says, since the masses trample on it, going to doctors, even though surgery is dangerous, God guards the fools. Our eyes see, thank God, that the great majority of patients for whom this surgery is done, God save us, are healed. So, we're okay, he says, with the idea of taking on a risk that is labeled normal, and to take that a step further, realistically, all medicine involves risk. Right? What medicine, what therapy doesn't have side effects? Right? Doctor, any medicines without side effects?
Yes, everything has side effects and allergic reactions. And everything requires a great amount of research, and research is risky because you don't know what you're going to find. Mm-hmm. So there is a great deal of risk in doing new things in medicine.
Right.
Well, even old things. Percentage, if you figure the percentage of loss,
right.
Percentage chance of doing serious harm to yourself by carrying on the surgery. You don't have to go through with it.
Right. The problem is always, well, what's my alternative? And what am I trying to avoid by engaging in the surgery? And one of the key factors is the question of what is the risk level? Where we'll say, you know, it's true. If you're an honest accountant, right, then you recognize that that when you say, well, only one person in 10,000 or one person in 50,000 has a negative effect, okay, but if you do this surgery on 100,000 people, that means you're going to cause this on average to 2 people, right? And if the medicine is taken by 50,000 people, 100,000 people, this problem is going to come up. And the only question is it going to be you? But it's going to be someone, and we are enabling that by putting a license on it. The Talmud has this really interesting line regarding the practice of medicine. The Torah describes a case in which one person attacks somebody else and wounds him. And it says that the person who wounds somebody else is obligated to pay for various elements of damage, time lost from work, humiliation, and so on. And one of the things he has to pay is medical bills. Because the Torah says, "V'rapo yirape," he shall heal the victim. On that, the Talmud says, since the Torah says to heal him, that shows that you're allowed to practice medicine. That's the Talmud statement, which is perplexing. Why do I need permission to practice medicine? I have an imperative to help people. Why isn't it obvious that practicing medicine is helping people? The Torah says, don't stand by while someone's blood is shed. So I have an obligation to help people. Why do I need permission to practice medicine? Rabbi Moses Nachmanides, in source number 7, writing in Spain in the 13th century, explained, it's because medicine has side effects. Or you can make mistakes. And the doctor might have said, I'm not going to read it out loud, you can see it there though. He says the doctor might say to himself, you know, I shouldn't practice lest I hurt somebody. And what the Talmud is telling me, the Torah is saying is, no, that's not the attitude. Yes, it's true, there are risks involved in medicine. Yes, it's true, you have to do everything you can to reduce those risks. But then you do it. And so Rabbi J. David Bleich, in source number 8, said in an article just several years ago, although every therapy is fraught with danger, the hazards of treatment are specifically sanctioned when incurred in conjunction with a therapeutic protocol. We are good with taking risk for treatment if it's part of trying to heal. Accordingly, the practice of the healing arts may be permitted, even if designed simply for the alleviation of pain. Even if it's just about alleviating pain, we're not curing something. He's still okay with it. So what we get out of this first sequence is, if you can use CRISPR with a level that society considers to be acceptable risk to treat cancer, to treat disease in an adult, the answer is treat it like every other medicine. Take it. That's what we would do. That's the first, and that's the easiest. The second segment of this I find to be very funny. And I shouldn't find it to be very funny. But I find it to be very funny anyway. We'll see if you agree with me. But in terms of the medicine, I just want to make sure I make the point clearly. I think it's actually going to be obligatory to use it. Meaning, it's obligatory in Judaism for us to pursue health. So therefore, if CRISPR can do that, and it's, again, the risk is reduced to an acceptable level, and defining acceptable level is an interesting question in its own right. But then it becomes something we must do. But case number two. Case number two is the case of the minor. All right? The extreme minor, the fertilized egg. Okay? You're going to do something to the fertilized egg. So take a look at source number two. This is, I think, the first article written from a Jewish law perspective on CRISPR. It's probably the first one I could find. It's from 2014. There were articles before that about genetic manipulation and stem cells and so on, but this is the first one to actually deal with the CRISPR type of gene editing. Right, Moshe Tendler, who is, I think, well-known as a bioethicist, and Dr. Joy Loike, who collaborates with him on quite a few articles. He says, the issue of violating the autonomy of the unborn child is considered a valid concern by secular bioethicists. In other words, how dare you manipulate the genes of the fertilized egg? Therefore, bioethicists would view it unethical to perform gene editing on the fertilized egg, fetus, or child. Rather, when a child reaches adulthood, he or she can decide whether to undergo gene editing. Now, he does acknowledge, however, bioethicists are more likely to support the application of gene editing to children that have fatal or untreatable genetic diseases, Tay-Sachs, Fragile X. In other words, if I don't do it now, I'm not going to save their life. it has to be done at this stage. But otherwise, they're concerned about the child's autonomy and don't want you manipulating the child's genes. Why do I find this funny? Because the same people, the same bioethicists, who are terribly bothered by the autonomy of this fertilized egg have zero trouble with abortion. You can kill it. You just can't give it blue eyes. No, that's the argument. That's the argument. I find that problematic.
Yep.
Do they necessarily feel that way about abortion? You're lumping them into a group.
Because I think the camp of secular bioethicists in general are okay with aborting a fertilized egg.
Yes.
I think that is true. I mean, the argument in response, if I want to be intellectually honest, is that the reason they're bothered by this sort of manipulation is less about the rights of this particular unborn and more a society-wide concern about what kind of a society you're going to create. But that's not the way they frame it. They say, this child has rights, and you can't change his eye color, and you can't make him smarter. It's up to him to make that decision. But if it's inconvenient right now, then you can take a pill, or you can do whatever, and then the child won't exist. We're good with that. So that's why I find this to be a little bit of an odd question of affecting the rights of the fertilized egg.
So in a sense, they're being dishonest.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so.
At what point, just to, at the risk of heading into a different area,
yeah.
At what point is abortion permissible and non-permissible?
From a Jewish perspective, you are indeed at risk of going in another direction.
Yeah.
To make a long story short, we are not the Catholic Church. There is already, going back to Talmudic times, a statement that where there's a risk to the health of the mother, you can abort up until the child's head emerges. If the child forms a risk to the mother's health, where the doctors, to the best of their medical knowledge, believe that carrying the child to term would be dangerous, one would abort up until the moment when the head comes out. At that point, all bets are off. What about for other concerns? Then it varies by stage of the pregnancy. Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg was a major authority in Jewish medical ethics. He passed away in 2003. And he wrote a responsum on abortion in the case of a Tay-Sachs baby and said that they could abort up until the seventh month.
Wow.
Seventh month being when the child was considered to be viable if the child were to be born at that point. He said that we could abort until then. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, also a very significant authority in Jewish law at the time, was horrified by this idea and said, absolutely not. But there are stages at which abortion for different motivations would be permitted, and to go beyond that would require that we dedicate the hour to it. But that's a brief answer. In terms of this issue, though, what do we say in Judaism about the rights of the child? So, Jewish law. Sorry.
Well, you see, it's an entirely different problem.
Yeah.
The rights of the mother supersede the rights of the child. But if that child is going to be allowed to live, then that child has rights to make their own decision. So it's a different problem.
So the child has a right to declare what eye color they want, but not a right to live.
Because
that's what you're saying.
What I'm saying is if the child is not in a position to make that decision when there is someone, another decision maker, the mother, that supersedes the rights of the child.
So the mother says, I want to carry a baby to term only if this baby is going to be high functioning intellectually. The mother has, I mean, this is, I'll give you a practical case. The child has Down syndrome. They find that out while the child is still in utero. You have the ability to do gene editing and eliminate the problem of Down syndrome from the child's genome, right? The mother says, I am willing to go through a pregnancy, but only if I know my child will not have Downs.
The ethicist says you can't do that to this child. You could abort, but you could not. You're violating the child's autonomy if the child is going to live. I understand the distinction you're drawing. I think that it breaks down in practice. That's my problem. Because at the end of the day, it's always going to be the mother's will versus the child's will.
These are very dangerous guns.
Yes. And that's part of where we have to go with this.
You're separating. You're saying having a child with blue eyes. The difference from genetically selecting a desirable child and genetically selecting for the elimination of disease, they can't sever the two? Like, just make it ethical for disease control.
Right. So I haven't read extensively in this debate, but the couple of articles that I've read have only drawn the distinction between that which must be done immediately to cure disease versus that which could be handled later on in the child's development when the child can actually make the decision, like the line in here about the, you know, Tay-Sachs and Fragile X. But I have to hope that someone would draw that distinction. Yes?
I was told that Judaism does not consider the fetus or the whatever there is a person till, as you said, a major part of the body has been delivered.
Yes and no. Yes and no.
The second thing is there was this case that applies where they repaired a significant heart defect in utero.
Yes.
So,
well, now
they do a lot.
I have to tell you, they're doing something even better now. They actually had a case in which they extracted the uterus from the mother to operate on spina bifida, and then put it back into the mother, which is just blows my mind.
Yeah,
yeah.
So this is happening.
Yeah,
they didn't go into the uterus. No,
they extracted the uterus from the body. They did the surgery by poking things into the uterus and keeping the uterus inflated via carbon dioxide.
Yeah.
And then they reinserted it in the mother. Yeah, it's just mind-blowing. Well, that's the idea. But the whole thing of taking the uterus out and putting it back in is so fraught.
Right.
It's like a transplant. Someone I know just had a double lung transplant the other night. It's the same thing. You take
right.
it out, you hook it.
Right.
A new sink.
Right. So in terms of this issue, and I'm going to cut this part of it a little bit shorter because I want to make sure to get to the third part. But Jewish law in general is not concerned for autonomy of the child as long as the decision is clearly in the child's advantage, like from an objective point of view, is it advantageous to the child? First of all, because we've already said that adults are obligated to pursue their best interests medically. If I have the option of pursuing a certain treatment that really is truly in my best interests, I'm supposed to pursue it anyway as an adult. So the kid has the same obligation. But more, parents will be obligated to do it for their children. Take a look at source number 10, a passage out of the Talmud. Our sages taught, a father's obligations to his son are to circumcise, no one asks the kid permission for that, no. Redeem, meaning if the child needs to be redeemed, pidyon haben, that practice, teach Torah too, marry off, and train in a trade. And some say to train him to swim. Mm. You have a responsibility to look after your child's livelihood, to look after your child's ability to survive. And not only parents, but as I noted in source number 11, I'm not going to read it out, but we have a concept of appointing legal guardians to look after the welfare of a child where there isn't a parent who can do it. And the classic question which comes up, because we have had cases like this, where a parent refuses medical treatment for a child, Judaism says, as recorded by David Zvi Hoffman in 19th century Germany in source number 12, he said it very clearly, we have never found anywhere in the Torah that parents may endanger their children and prevent the doctor from healing them. He says, ain't any such thing. The parent does not have the right to decline. He says, that's the law of the Torah. He says, I don't know municipal law. You want to tell me what the law is in the local government? Fine. But from a Jewish perspective, the parents do not have the right to decline. And the calculation in source number 13, Rabbi Mordechai Halperin, writing in Israel, says the calculation has to simply be the minor's benefit. He says it is clear that the decision must consider only the minor's benefit and no foreign general concerns, such as the good of the parents or society. What is in this child's best interest? That's how you make your calculation. What about where your decision is not medical? What about where it's aesthetic? So here, too, we try to have a somewhat objective standard. Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, who I mentioned earlier, dealt with orthodonture. Someone wrote to him and asked him a question. How old can a child be before the child is allowed to refuse orthodonture? That was the question that was put to him. And he said basically 13, 14. He felt that's when the child is able to refuse, which is bad, because often that's when they need it. But if you take a look at source number, the truth is he dealt with orthodonture as medical, meaning he viewed that as a medical need. But take a look at source number 14, Rabbi Yitzhak Zilberstein, a contemporary writer, deals with the issue of removing a birthmark. Something that's aesthetic, not where there's a concern for a skin cancer development, just purely aesthetic.
Yeah.
And he says, I put the question before my father-in-law and mentor, Rabbi Yosef Shalom Eliashiv, who you may have heard of, was one of the leading authorities in Jewish law in Israel until he passed away 3 or 4 years ago. He replied that they should carry out the treatment now as a benefit to the child. Don't wait till he's an adult. And just the opposite. He says if they would not treat now, the child would have a claim against his parents in the future. If the birthmarks would cause his spouse to recoil. If at that point he finds himself unpleasing to his spouse, it's the parents' fault for not having taken care of it earlier.
So, it's fault.
Yes, it's always. It's always the parents' fault.
Yeah,
you got
the
it.
The parents, the mother, right?
Yes. You still have to have sort of a floor. You have to have a point at which we stop parents from operating on their children. Something that's just not considered to be objectively therapeutic. Right? There has to be a mark where you say, okay, this doesn't count. You know, let's say the child is going to be 5'9", right, which I think is basically average height. And the parent says, yeah, but I could get CRISPR and the child could now be 6'2". Right? Now what do you do? Is that considered to be a normal thing, or is that something that really the parent doesn't have the right to do on behalf of the child, or even, go back to germline therapy, untold future generations of
However,
children?
If the statistics are accurate and they tell us that taller people are more successful, or it's easier for them to achieve certain levels in society, then the parent could say it's not for aesthetics. It's not for me.
Yep.
It's for your future.
And
it may be baloney, but that's what they could say.
Right. And I think that's where you get into the hard decisions.
Yeah.
I know, in all seriousness. This brings me to the third part, which I wanted to make sure we would get to. Eternal skin, blue-eyed babies, and Jewish values. We now...
Blue-eyed babies aren't big with us.
Okay. We now jump off from Jewish law considerations, right? We talked about Jewish law, really, in terms of are you allowed to endanger your health and are you allowed to make decisions for your child. Jewish law now, it stops at the door, so to speak. And now we get into areas of Jewish values. And this is dicey territory. Take a look at source number 15, please. Rabbi Tendler and Dr. Loike, in their article, Tampering with the Genetic Code of Life, they write the following. Currently, there is no medical research institution in the United States, currently meaning 2014, that approves germline genetic therapies. There are many reasons for such caution and concerns. As mentioned above, there is great fear that this technology will tamper with the evolution of human beings. In addition, there is concern that gene editing systems may be applied to alter or modify physical or behavioral characteristics rather than curing diseases, and should therefore be prohibited. Finally, ethical issues related to designer babies are relevant to gene editing technologies and introduce the concern that gene editing procedures will foster eugenics. That is what we're talking about, right? That's the fear, that you're going to create a society in which you have to have a certain level of intelligence, you have to have a certain level of athletic ability, and otherwise you become an outcast. You know, they want to breed you out of society. Now, there is nothing in strict Jewish law against pursuing beauty or against pursuing particular traits in a baby. Right? There is an issue that men shouldn't groom themselves in a way that is exclusively feminine. Okay, fine. But that's really basically it. You know, in fact, it's considered therapeutic to help somebody to look better, where to look the way that they look now is causes them indignity. Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg is a pediatric neurologist in Israel and an expert on Jewish bioethics. And he talks about the case in which parents wanted to go through PGD. Right? PGD, again, is where you create a number of fertilized eggs, a number of embryos, and you decide which ones you're going to implant. And it's usually done where there is some serious disease, and they don't want to implant an embryo that has this serious disease, so they'll create a few embryos and implant the ones that don't have the disease. But the case that he's dealing with is where they're concerned for baldness. That's what they want to avoid, is baldness. So you look at it and say, well, come on. Really?
Yeah.
But then he gives you the rest of the details of the case. The rest of the details of the case are that it's early onset baldness in childhood, and it's a Hasidic family. And this child is going to go through, forget Chinuch, this child's going to go to school, and you've seen Hasidic kids with their very long payas, right, the long coiled sideburns, and they're all going to be running around with them, and he's not going to have them. And it's going to cause him trauma as a kid to look different from everybody else. There's a fine line, and maybe it's sometimes fine and sometimes it's not fine, but there's a definite line between aesthetics and human dignity. Sometimes that which to you and me, you know, doesn't look like a big deal, to somebody else is reasonably a very big deal. So that's something that's worth noting.
Does that apply at all with people who have surgery to change their, like, men who want to become female and
right.
stuff have surgery?
So that's a whole other discussion.
No, I know.
That is a very big can of worms.
But I thought that it's sort of something a little bit like...
It is, but there you run into other issues in terms of Jewish law, so I don't want to go there right now.
And maybe being 6'2" is going to be human dignity.
You know, I mean, certainly if you live in a society in which everybody is 6'2" and, you know, the rest of them are 5'5", and, you know, and that can be, no, that can, I don't think it's impossible to imagine a world like that.
Yeah.
So what was the...
So his argument there was that it was justified. So as far as selecting...
So then you kill the other embryo.
So the question is, what do you do with the other embryos? And that's a debate in Jewish law. How do you view them? Do you view them as a partial life or not? Some say you can freeze them. Some say that you can dispose of them. That's its own fascinating discussion in its own right.
But you don't want them.
Correct.
I mean, you've made a selection on whatever basis you've made it.
Right.
And you've left two behind.
Right.
But it's happening.
True.
So why freeze them?
And the answer is, because you can't bring yourself to end them.
Are you permitted to end them?
But that's what I'm saying. That's the debate. There are those who say yes, and there are those who disagree. Surprise.
CRISPR would make that unnecessary.
Right. Well, that's the idea. CRISPR would eliminate the problem.
Oh.
Now you don't need to pick a particular one. You produce whatever you produce. Yeah. You look at it. You see what you want to remove. Snip, and back in, and implant it, and that's it.
But if you could commit therapies, if you could raise babies with blue eyes and blonde hair.
Well, that's right. So this is what we have to discuss. There are Jewish, it's true, there are Jewish values which seem to oppose the pursuit of physical beauty or physical uniformity to look like everybody else. I want to bring you a few possibilities here for sources that go that route. There's a very memorable response of Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg in source number 16. He was asked about cosmetic surgery for a woman who felt that she couldn't find a shidduch, she couldn't find a spouse because of her looks. And Rabbi Waldenberg was very against the surgery. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein permitted. Rabbi Waldenberg was very against. Take a look at what he says. Source 16, he says, it's entirely ridiculous, right? Tell us what you really think. It's entirely ridiculous to suggest to permit such surgery for women by amassing leniencies from various midrashim which praise women's beauty. To say, oh, look, the midrash praises the woman's beauty and therefore it's something you should pursue. It is not even worth responding to this, for such things have no place in law at all. Only as a homiletic would I respond with the words of King Solomon, who spoke with his divine inspiration, saying, charm is false and beauty is vain. A woman who reveres God is to be praised. You're looking at the wrong things. It's not about what you look like. Sheker achein ve'hevel hayofi, we're familiar with the line. Anyone with reverence for God in her heart would not stray after such fads of plastic surgery for aesthetics alone, most of which is just for appearances and whims of human beings, no two of whom were created to look alike. If one should not trouble God to alter nature, he brings a passage from the Talmud which is against asking God to change the way things are to make us happy, how much more so should one not try to be smart and change nature with such activities, which would be like telling the craftsman who made him, how ugly is this vessel you made? Mm-hmm. He is not happy with this idea. He's referring in that last bit to a classic story out of the Talmud in which somebody insults somebody else and calls him ugly, and the fellow responds to him saying, go tell my creator that he did bad work. If you take a look at source number 17, a Talmudic passage valuing diversity, our sages taught, one who sees Jewish crowds says, quote, blessed is the wise one of secrets, in the Hebrew, Baruch Chacham Harazim. What does that mean? For their intellects do not resemble each other and their forms do not resemble each other. We consider it a positive thing that God created diversity among humanity. And here, not just to make Harvey happy, but because I felt it was on point, I bring you a little bit of a poem by Rav Kook. The poem is called El Chiki Shofar. It's a beautiful poem on the importance of everybody playing a role. And just a little bit of a translation of his poem. He says, we will not measure every acquisition by our personal measure. We will know that each individual is only a unit, one portion, a share of our community. And how could the whole judge but little? One whose work is in Torah, in fine points of law, if he would depart to sing songs, to examine poetry, his profit would equal his loss in these tasks. His work would ascend in smoke, his learning would be uprooted. This person is a person who studies. Or one who turns his heart to analysis of history, books of generations, chronicles of days, there too he will find gold and precious coins. There he will build a temple to knowledge in the heights. And one whose heart is given to mundane wisdoms, to medicine, to nature, to mathematics, to chemistry, and his heart thirsts and broadens like the depths to enjoy the benefits of branching fruitful knowledge. Each person toward his heart's desire will travel and succeed. From the fruit of their hands, their nation will be elevated. Each in his trade will breathe the breath of life. When he builds for himself a home, the ruin of our people will be rebuilt. He says, you need a nation which consists of people who do different things, have different interests. You don't want to create a society in which everybody is alike. There are also those who are concerned about the playing God aspect of things. Take a look, please, at source number 19, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Lau, right? Quite well known, was the chief rabbi, Holocaust survivor, wrote a magnificent biography which is available in Hebrew and in English. Right? The English, I think, is called From the Depths. I think is what the English is called. Something like that. He says, the moment medical science tries to take upon itself duties in areas which are not its responsibility, such as shortening life, cloning, or creating life in an unnatural way, we must set down borders in order not to harm the Jewish basic belief that there is a creator of the universe in whose hands life and death are placed. He does not like the idea, he's writing regarding cloning, of manipulating it. I should note that's not the universal view. I brought you source number 20 from the Maharal of Prague, in which he says, no, everything that human beings do is part of nature, because we are part of nature. If God didn't want us to be able to do it, he wouldn't have given us the talent to do it. If you don't have a law that says no, then the answer is yes. That's his argument. He says it's not called playing God. for you to be involved in this. Now, of course, he said this in the 16th century, right? Long before people were cloning. You could argue, you know, you have the famous legend that he created a golem. So maybe he knew something about this. But that's a legend, and the Maharal did not create a golem. I apologize. I don't want to deflate anything.
It's like in vitro fertilization, which is...
Yeah, I mean it's more natural than this. They, but yeah, there are some who argued against in vitro fertilization. Today, it's gained pretty broad acceptance in the observant Jewish world. But there were those who argued when it first came out, and I think, it's particular in the Christian world, there were those who were very strongly against that.
Until one of them needs it.
This may be, but that's human behavior. So the question is this: let's say that you can identify sources like the ones we've brought that declare Jewish values. Is that binding? It's okay. Rabbi Waldenberg doesn't think that we should be pursuing aesthetics. The Talmud thinks that we value diversity. But is this binding as law? It's a fascinating question, and it's not one that admits of a short answer, but that's exactly what I'm going to do, because we're at 55 minutes in.
What was Feinstein's...
Feinstein disagreed with him, but largely because of her need. He felt that you have to respect the statement that she's making, that she's not able to find someone. Yes. So this leads to the question of our values binding, and I'd like to offer the following distinction. I think there are two types of values situations in Judaism. There is obligation, and there is aspiration. Sometimes, and I'm going to skip the sources by and large, but I'm going to tell you what they say, and you can read up as you choose. Sometimes the Torah expresses an explicit commandment to draw on our values. Sometimes the Torah actually says, use your head, figure it out. I have given you values that you are meant to apply. So, for example, verse in Leviticus, Kadoshim Tehiyu, you shall be holy. God doesn't say what holy means. It's up to you to figure out what holiness is. I brought Nachmanides on it in number 22. Or a verse in Deuteronomy, Hebrew, Vasisa Hayashar Vehatov. You shall do that which is just and good. Now go figure out what just and good are. Use your values. Another one, popular, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Right? All sorts of applications, but it's on us to figure out what that looks like. Last one, do not degrade yourselves. You're not allowed to conduct yourself in a way that is degrading to yourself. Baal Tishak Tzu is the Hebrew of it. The kids in day school love to quote that one, because one of the applications that the Talmud brings for that is that if you have to use the washroom, you should go right away. So they raise their hand, they say, I gotta go. And the teacher says, class is over in 10 minutes. And they say, but Baal Tishak Tzu, you're not allowed. That's the way they deal with it. But in these cases, values are actually an obligation. The Torah says, implement this. You have to figure it out, but implement it. Other times, values are an aspiration, where the Torah expresses an implicit command to draw on values, but it's not knocking at the door and saying, this is what you must do. Rabbi Usher Weiss, a rabbi in Israel today who answers questions for Shaarei Tzedek Hospital, in bioethics, calls this Ritzon HaTorah. I think that this is what he means when he refers to the Ritzon HaTorah. Ritzon HaTorah means the desire of the Torah. There are certain things which the Torah does not command, but as you learn it, you glean from it, this is what it wants of you. His specific example is the following case. There's an earliest time for prayer in the morning, right, relative to dawn, sunrise. There's an earliest time before which you're not supposed to pray. Okay, what if I come home from a late night party and it's 4 a.m, the earliest time to pray is at 5. I know full well that if I go to sleep, I'm going to sleep right through the time for prayer in the morning. On the other hand, do I have any obligation to wait till 5 o'clock and then be able to pray? Right now, I'm not obligated. It's 4 o'clock, not 5 o'clock. And his answer is, letter of the law, you can go to sleep. Letter of the law, you have no obligation right now, and you wake up when you wake up. And we're talking about someone who says, forget my alarm clock, it ain't going to happen. However, he adds that that's clearly not what God wants of you. He doesn't want you to seek an exemption from a commandment. To say, well, I'm going to go to sleep and then I won't be, and then I won't be obligated. It's not what the Torah wants. There is a sense of what God wants of us. And if you take a look, this quote I like very much. Source number 25. This one I will work with. Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein. In a classic essay called Does Judaism Recognize an Ethic Independent of Halacha? He says, essentially then, the question is whether halacha is self-sufficient. Is everything God wants me to do in halacha? There's nothing else beyond it that I'm supposed to do. And he says, if, however, we equate halacha with the din, with the law, if we mean that everything can be looked up, every moral dilemma resolved by reference to code or canon, the notion is both palpably naive and patently false. It's not true that everything you have to do is included in written law. The Chazon Ish, for one, he says, Chazon Ish, Rabbi Avraham Yeshaya Karelitz, a leader in the middle of the 20th century in Israel, both his saintliness and his rigorous halachic commitment are legend, had no such illusions. Moral duties, he once wrote, sometimes constitute one corpus with halachic rulings, and it is halakha that defines the proscribed and permitted of ethical thought. Sometimes moral duties are the same as halakha. Sometimes, but not evidently always. There are moments when one must seek independent counsels. And that's what I'm getting at here. That sometimes you're expected to employ your values. So I have a couple of examples of this. In the interest of time, I'm not going to go into it at any length. But you have a biblical command that God gives to Moshe, to Moses. He says, you, Moshe, shall warn the Jews of the laws and the Torah. That's the law. And you shall inform them of a path on which they shall walk and the deed they shall perform. Right? This is the portion of Yitro when we're dealing with the assignment of judges and what Moshe's job is and what the judge's job is. And Yitro, that Moshe's father-in-law, gives him advice. This is from that section. So the Talmud understands here that the first part of the sentence is about teaching the Jews law. The second part of it is about teaching them to transcend the law, as applied in source number 27, acts of kindness, burial, justice, going beyond the letter of the law. These are areas in which we are meant to aspire to more. That's something that we expected to do more of. Now, let me ask you a question here. In case anyone's sleeping, you know that with the time change, it's now an hour later, technically. This is not so easy. It's not easy for me either. But why are there aspirations? Why not make everything law? Why didn't God make everything law? Why is he putting me in this position? Sorry, why is she putting me in the position of having to figure things out? If God doesn't want me to take steps for aesthetic purposes, to manipulate the genes, right? Leave aside that God wasn't going to write, don't manipulate genes, in a Torah that he was giving 3,400 years ago. I can respect that. But why didn't God give me explicit instructions about these values? Why is there such a thing as transcending the letter of the law at all?
Because he also gave me free will.
Well, I have free will to choose whether to follow the law or not.
Mm-hmm. But I think it bears on free will.
Mm-hmm.
That if everything was written down, there's no need for free will.
But there,
if everything was carved in stone.
But there is, because I exercise my free will every time I follow a command, every time I decide not to go into a non-kosher restaurant, every time I, whatever, fill in the blank, whatever decision a person is making religiously. Even if they're following a law, it's their own volition that leads them to do that. I had a friend of mine who was a Reform rabbi who used to tell me that Orthodox people don't have free will because they're just obedient to the law. And my response to him was always, where do you think that decision to follow the law comes from? That's an exercise in free will. Yeah.
We were at a lunch when the speaker said that what the Jews have given to the world is a lack. They're not happy with the way things are. They always want to improve. So I think if everything was there, we have an intellect and we're able to improve society or improve the world and stuff. And we're given that, and I'll even say that that's the same speaker, it was Shimon Peres, who said that why we are called made in the image of God is because we have an intellect that we can think.
So in other words, there's value to our innovation, is what you're saying. So I would like to suggest a few ideas which may border on that. Pearlie, you were going to say?
I'm just going to say the Torah is really a very small book. And it's small because for many reasons, and I don't know what God was thinking. But from our standpoint, it's small because it can be taken. It can be transported with us wherever we go. And it's small because it allows for things to crop up that are not there, and for us to deal, call it free will or call it ingenuity, but it allows for us to reinterpret as the world changes. The Torah doesn't change, but our approach to it may. Not necessarily will, but may.
Right. No, I understand what you're saying. So I would say a few things, some of which incorporates what Pearlie is saying, some of which what Harvey is saying. I think one idea is an idea that's found in the Talmud, which states, "Makom hinichu lanu avoseinu lihisgader ba." Our ancestors left us room to make our own mark. There are things which are left for us, and this goes back to exercise of our own intellect. It could be that it's as simple as saying there's value in, and maybe this is what you were saying about free will also. Maybe this is where you were going with it. There's value in us actually figuring it out. And that's one element. Another element may just be it's impractical to cover everything in law. It's just too big and unwieldy. A third element might really be the need for flexibility, to be able to address new circumstances as they come up.
But it does. You can see how rabbinic, in certain cases, whether it was transplants or all kinds of stuff, initially the response is one way, and then with the times, the response changes.
To a certain,
not all the time, but...
I mean, look, the environment changes, the situation changes, and you need to be able to address a new world. But I think the most interesting to me, not to disagree with any of what's been said, because I think these are all valid answers, but to me, the most interesting idea comes from a piece by Dr. Jim Sabin. Take a look at source number 30. He wrote an essay called, "What If Madoff Took an Ethics Class?"
He would have failed.
He says, "In medical ethics teaching, most time is spent on teasing out the pros and cons of complex ethical conundrums. But in real life, recognizing and acknowledging that there is a conundrum that requires contemplation is as important as the way we reason about it. In other words, it's a really important exercise for us to go through to try to figure out what the ethics ought to be and not simply have a book that gives us guidelines. It's a learning experience for us." And as Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein writes in number 31, conscience has a role to play.
So
we need to evolve that.
The difference of humans is this. That's what makes us human.
Well, it's certainly what makes us valuable.
Okay.
And so I think that's where aspiration comes in, is the ability to not only follow a set of rules, but to grow in applying them via these values. And I think that's what God expects of us, is to do that. So when we go back to CRISPR and we say, not can I use this as medicine, we're good with using it as medicine as long as it's safe. Not can I use it on the fertilized egg, because once again, if it's in the child's objective best interests, we're going to be good with that. But in terms of the question of, can I use it for eternal skin? Can I use it for blue eyes? Can I use it for those areas? Can I use it to eliminate the variety that is humanity in order to get everybody to have what I've decided are the optimal character traits? That's why we look back to our sources and say, these values are not simply nice ideas and philosophies. They're meant to have real-world applications. We are very varied. And our values may end up being different. The things that we discern may end up being different. But fundamentally, that's what we need to discern is, so what can we come up with collectively? And from that, determine our practice. Thank you very much.